I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we'll talk with an economist from the National Association of Home Builders about the housing market, both in Spokane and nationwide. He'll be in Spokane Thursday for a local home builders conference. But first, the debate about Medicaid expansion in Idaho continues with the introduction of a new bill that has a provision that expansion supporters knew would be coming.
It also adds a mandatory work requirement that is for able-bodied adults that matches what is currently being used in the department for the SNAP program.
That's Representative John Vanderwoude. He's a Republican from Nampa. The SNAP program to which he refers is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, food stamps. The House Health and Welfare Committee agreed Monday to print Vanderwoude's bill and give it a hearing. It differs in one way from the work requirements for the food stamp program.
It says that the able-bodied adult is exempt if they have children under six. This one changes it for Medicaid purposes. They are exempt from the work requirement if they have kids under 18. So that was, I think, a good step to try to help have parents home when the kids are teenagers.
Vanderwoude calls his bill the Idaho way of implementing Proposition 2.
Which has certain good sideboards on it that I think are necessary in order to implement the program properly.
Can you tell me a few specifics about it?
It has mandatory work requirement. It has also seeking a waiver to allow the people from 100 to 138 that are currently on the exchange, giving them the option of whether they stay on this exchange and get the subsidy or whether they want to go to Medicaid. So we're not forcing anybody onto Medicaid. We're trying to give them that option that they can pick which one they want. It has a sunset on it if the federal reimbursement rate goes below 90%. Then the legislature will take a look at it and see if we want to continue the program. It also has what they call an IMD waiver, which is a mental health disorder. It allows the couple of mental hospitals, I believe one in Cottonwood and one in Boise, that currently do not qualify for Medicaid payments. It allows them to qualify for Medicaid payments, which will help any people in the gap here if they need some mental health treatments and stuff like that. So it, then they would qualify for reimbursement on the Medicaid. It has a sunset that if the federal courts determine that it is unconstitutional, then the whole program automatically sunsets. It also has currently on Medicaid, you're allowed to look back and Medicaid will pick up the bill up to 90 days. This is asking for a reduction down to 30 days. Trying to think. Oh, it also has drug screening for the purpose of directing those people to a treatment program.
Why is this bill needed?
Because there's a lot of opportunities to, one thing, do I want to force people onto Medicaid who are currently have a private insurance policy? Do I want to force them to go on Medicaid, or do I want to give them the option of choosing whether they go on Medicaid? Those people that currently are on the exchange have a private insurance policy and can go to any doctor that maybe, you know, the doctor they have they like, but maybe that doctor, and we know several doctors, have limited how many Medicaid patients they can afford to take. So this gives those people the option of possibly staying with that doctor that they have and getting reimbursed on the regular rate instead of the Medicaid rates. You know, there's 20,000 people currently on the exchange getting private insurance that are in this 100 to 138%. And if we can keep those people on private insurance instead of going on Medicaid, I think that's a benefit to the state and a benefit to the people if they so choose.
Now, obviously, the one provision that's catching everybody's attention is the work provision. Why is that a part of your bill?
Because the idea, I think, of every government program should be that we help people up and out of where they're at. And so if we can provide training, opportunities to find better jobs or get training to get a better job and to be working and moving in that direction so that they're no longer on the program, I think that's what we need to do. And so this is to try to make sure that people don't get trapped in Medicaid, but that they are able to move on up and get it, become self-sufficient and be on their own.
And are there penalties for folks who can't quite reach those requirements that you're setting out in your bill?
If they don't reach the work requirements, they will be dropped from Medicaid, but they can come back on in 2 months. So okay. It's just a temporary deal. It's not a lifetime deal. It's not a one-year deal. They can come back in another 2 months and reapply.
So where do you think are the areas that are going to be easiest to compromise on with your Democratic colleagues?
I think the Democrat colleagues will be fine with the IMD waiver. I'm hoping they're fine with the waiver giving people the opportunity to stay on the exchange. I don't believe the only one that I get the most angst on is the work requirement, whether it's mandatory or voluntary.
And you think the most of the people of Idaho would support a work requirement?
I think so.
Supporters of Medicaid expansion say this is another attempt to stop or tamp down the implementation of Proposition 2, which was approved by voters in November. A legal challenge to the initiative was denied by the state Supreme Court. 2 weeks ago, two bills that would have stopped implementation of the initiative were narrowly defeated in committee before they could be introduced. Representative Muffy Davis is a Democrat from Blaine.
The majority of the people have outright told us exactly what they want. I have not received one email from people asking me to put work requirements or limit Medicaid expansion. I have received hundreds from people asking me to implement it the will and the way the voters voted for it. People that we were reaching out for Proposition 2 here in Idaho, this gap population that we were looking to fill, most of them are already working Idahoans. So this just adds a level of bureaucracy in being able to verify that work requirement, costing state taxpayers a bunch of money to follow up and chase that down. And then people that are valid for that Medicaid could fall through the gaps and, again, continue to be uninsured. So that's the biggest issue that I have with that. There are several other things that he has, waivers he requests from the federal government, most of which seem to be okay. There's an option of people staying on the exchange possibly if they want to. I don't know why people would want to do that. Those people are paying exorbitant amounts to get coverage. I'm not sure. I know the reason that we have this need is because they aren't able to afford that health insurance. But whether or not the federal government will offer those waivers is another question as well.
So the battle against Medicaid expansion continues. The state Supreme Court has already taken it up. You've had one committee that's already said no to a bill. Why do you think this continues to go on?
You know, it's a good question. I what we heard in the first bill that we voted down in health and welfare or voted from getting a print hearing, the biggest explanation that the bill sponsors said was that they didn't really believe that the people knew what they were voting for when they voted to pass Prop 2 and Medicaid expansion. And for me, I just find that really offensive to the voters of Idaho. I believe there's probably not one issue that we are dealing with this year that they voters know more about than this, and that they came out in force, and we had organizing committees throughout districts and communities all over the state. And, I mean, these are their friends, their neighbors, their family members that are hurting because they are not able to afford health insurance. We have our rural hospitals struggling to stay afloat because of the uninsured people that are coming in. This is a crisis in our state, and I don't know why a bunch of legislators are refusing to listen to the will of the people or believing that the people that actually voted to put them in office don't know what they're talking about. So
one of the arguments is that right now 90% of the Medicaid expansion would be paid by the federal government, 10% by the state. And some of these efforts say if that's going to go beyond 10%, then the state just can't afford it anymore. Do you worry that the federal government is going to shift more of that cost to the state?
I do not worry that that is an immediate issue going on. I don't believe that that is something that is being even discussed or even tossed around right now. The federal government appears to be having a lot of discussions around trying to want to increase medical options for all. So I don't believe that's on the table. I believe it's a valid concern that if it does come on the table, but I don't see it as an emergency. I think, you know, I'm okay with an opt-out if there's a sunset or, you know, if things change that we need to re-examine, not that it necessarily instantly, like some of these bills, cuts off, but that it needs to be re-examined and see, you know, but this year, through the appropriations, they have found funding for Medicaid as instituted through Proposition 2, Medicaid expansion. There is funding for that. We figured out how to do it. What we don't know how to do is find the extra funding that this current bill, which will be House Bill 228, is implying and asking for the state.
So you've already referred a little bit to this, but I want you to expand on it again. Explain some of those extra costs that you're talking about to the state treasury if work requirements and other requirements are thrown onto the Medicaid expansion.
So basically, in the fiscal note that we see right here, there's one-time, like, initial startup costs to get things going. Essentially what that is just all of the internal structure costs. But then the ongoing cost, this is the issue, is there is an ongoing state share of about $1.5 million every year, just based on his fiscal note, which doesn't include other estimates of those people that may fall off and come into that secondary gap and continue in our rural hospitals and still be uninsured and need to continue our indigent and catastrophic care funds. So there's $1.5 million minimum that we know of that's ongoing that is the administrative costs to have someone in there checking to make sure that these work requirements are being met. Now, I would much rather take that $1.5 million and put it into our pre-K or education or some of the other severely underfunded programs that we have instead of wasting it to prove that people are actually doing what they are already doing.
So the Health and Welfare Committee's already voted one of these bills down, one of these challenges. What do you think about this bill?
This one, I have a feeling it's going to be going to the floor. It was voted along party lines. There wasn't a whole lot of discussion. I mean, we will have a hearing. We will have more testimony. But it seems like the parties that be, the majority party seems really want to have this discussion on the House floor. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see it on the House floor. Hopefully we'll be able to stop it there on the floor and make the legislators listen to the will of the people. If not, we may be dependent on the Senate to keep some sanity here.
Muffy Davis is a Democratic representative from Blaine. John Vanderwoude's bill is scheduled for a committee hearing on Friday. With the economy slowing, home building will be an important factor to keep an eye on. In many places, demand is greater than supply, driving up the costs of housing. Robert Dietz is the chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. He will give the keynote speech Thursday at the Real Estate Development and Construction Conference sponsored by the Spokane Home Builders Association.
Over the course of 2018, and in fact, stretching back years before that, housing affordability has been on a general decline. And some of that is due to higher interest rates. And what we saw at the back half of 2018 was a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage near 5%. It was really high enough to slow the home sales market down. And that's a bit of a surprise because 5% rate still sounds pretty low. But the problem is that over the last 5 or 6 years in the post-recession period, we've had home price growth faster than income growth. And when that occurs, you have declining housing affordability. So on a nationwide basis, for example, in 2012, nationwide, about 8 out of 10 home sales were affordable for a typical family. Today, it's closer to 6 out of 10. And so that decline has really kind of put that housing affordability element in focus. Now, with respect to Spokane, the same trends are in play, which is, for example, in 2013 in Spokane, 9 out of 10 home sales were affordable for a typical family. Today, it's closer to 6 out of 10. And the reasons for the decline or for the increase in pricing is we have a combination of thin resale inventory. That's in part due to the fact that people are moving less often than they used to. But it's also due to lackluster construction over the last few years, particularly on the single-family side. And so to kind of wrap things up, what I'm going to do is look at some of the supply-side reasons that we've had either a lack of volume growth or volume growth on single-family construction that was of higher price and thus pushed up home prices. And I'd say the most important of those in 2018 was the ongoing labor shortage in the construction industry. We're short about 300,000 workers. And then building material price volatility. And we particularly saw that in lumber markets, where lumber prices at one point during 2018 were up about 60%, 60% since the start of 2017. And some of that was due to tariffs on Canadian softwood lumber. So I'll go through all that. We'll have some material and demographics, and then I'll kind of put it all together in our forecast. And on a nationwide basis, builders are still have positive market confidence, but it remains a little diminished. And we're looking for, in 2019, single-family construction growth to be less than 2%, so fairly close to flat. There's some growth prospects in inner suburb locations. Anytime the builders can build a density, like townhouse construction, townhouses are actually, townhouse construction's up 24% over the last year. I mean, that market is just really hot right now. And then on multifamily apartment construction, we think that market will be down a little bit this year compared to 2018, and we're basically looking for that market to level off.
Here in the city of Spokane, just recently, our city council voted to change the city code a little bit in order to allow for more townhouse development and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. as a way to sort of trigger for, if not for low-income folks, at least for medium-income folks. Are you seeing more of that sort of thing, sort of creative sort of responses in other cities?
Yes. So townhouse construction growth, that attempt to build the density is rising in terms of volume in places like Washington, D.C., Boston, markets that have a lot of population growth and job growth, income growth, places where it could use more of that in terms of adding at the entry level would be some of the coastal markets in places like Seattle and Portland and the large California markets. And what we see it is in terms of the impacts on what's being built in terms of the construction data. So median new home size for new single-family homes has been declining over the last 3 years. That reflects builders trying to add inventory at the entry level. And I think what we've learned over the last 3 or 4 years is if communities can zone in a cost-effective way, in other words, ways that minimize the amount of land that's required to build single-family housing, and that includes townhouses as well as single-family detached homes, there is a ready market for that kind of home. And, you know, the primary buyer that you're trying to get is a millennial who, if you look at the population distribution of millennials, their peak age is in their late 20s, and they're moving into their 30s in growing numbers. So they're looking for that single-family home, that suburban aesthetic and the opportunity to become a homeowner. But in our preference data, we do find that they want a little more walkability. And so if a community can zone with some additional density, that will allow builders to add additional units of housing.
There's one other point that I wanted to go back to that you had mentioned, and that is the shortage of construction workers nationwide, and that seems to be growing. Why do you think that is?
Part of it is a consequence of the Great Recession itself. The residential construction industry lost 1.5 million workers during and after the Great Recession. That was due to the fact that home construction very notably fell off. I mean, at the peak decline, single-family starts were down about 80% their peak pace. So as the industry has rebuilt its infrastructure after the Great Recession, it needed to rebuild its workforce. It had to rebuild its pipeline of land and lots that were available for construction. It also had to reestablish its sources of lending in terms of community banks. All of those take time. And what we've seen in the data, both survey data as well as government employment data, is that rebuilding the labor force is a long-run project. Part of the challenge is that when we survey younger workers, there is a resistance to coming into work in the construction industry, despite the fact that it does represent one of the skilled workforces in the U.S. economy and is often a good place to start a business. So someone who starts off as a learning skills of carpentry or plumbing or electrical work or as a stonemason could in a number of years launch their own business or become a remodeler or their own subcontractor. In the survey data, we've seen as more people go to four-year colleges that they don't want to take construction work that's outside or physical. They want to work mostly in offices looking at screens, and that's a challenge. So the construction industry in terms of solutions has got to pursue two approaches at the same time. One is to recruit new workers into the industry. We're currently short about 300,000 construction workers. So organizations like NAHB, like our sister organization, the Home Builders Institute, which helps train new construction workers, can tackle that by working with trade schools and community colleges. The second thing that the residential construction industry in particular has to work on is increasing worker productivity. And in simple terms, this means building more with less. We have to find ways to increase the amount of construction activity that can be accomplished by individual workers. That has two consequences, by the way. One, it can increase the industry's output, and we need more remodeling, we need more apartments, we need more single-family homes. But by increasing worker productivity, you also increase the long-run sustainable rate of wages that can be paid in an industry. Builders can't just simply raise wages if prices don't adjust, because ultimately they will be working on unaffordable projects, and that will reduce supply. But if productivity is up, then you can pay workers more over the long run. And that's good for the workers, it's good for businesses, and it's good for homeowners and renters looking for new supply. So, you know, it's a twofold challenge of both recruiting workers and increasing worker productivity. It's going to take time. There are no silver bullets. And we see, you know, the beginnings of things like a rising share of modular construction and a rising share of panelized construction, which is where either the whole house or parts of the house are essentially made in a factory and then transported and assembled at the home site. They're pretty small market shares. Collectively, those two approaches represent less than 4% of single-family housing construction starts. So that market share is going to go up, and that's one way that we can get a productivity gain in the industry.
Robert Dietz is the chief economist for the National Association of Home Builders. He'll speak Thursday morning at the Real Estate Development and Construction Conference in Spokane. To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, in NPR One, or Google Play. Or you can find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Tell us what you think of the program by sending your comments to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Thank you for listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.